Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
It's Monday, the 9th of May. Good morning and welcome to Africa Link with me, Jane Ayeko Kumet. In today's program, the Kenyan government plans to close all refugee camps and deport all refugees seeking protection in the country. But how have those affected reacted?
I'm very proud to go in Somalia. It's my country. But there in Somalia, there is no security. You know, in Kenya, we have education. But in Somalia, we don't have.
In Uganda, the capital Kampala is tinted with military as government heavily deploys security personnel in the streets ahead of President Yoweri Museveni's inauguration.
The Forum for Democratic Change, the official political party for Kizza Besigye, who stood for elections, insist that they are going to continue with their defiance campaign, and this includes demonstrating against what they think is rights that have been denied.
All that coming up shortly. Stay tuned.
Top story.
We start in Kenya, where the government plans to close all refugee camps and deport all those seeking protection in the country. It cites insecurity and economic burden as the main reasons. Kenya currently shelters more than 600,000 refugees. Authorities say the tripartite agreement signed by Kenya and the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees and the Somalia government in 2013 for the repatriation of refugees has been extremely slow. From Kenya, Andrew Wasike reports.
A statement from the Ministry of Interior said that Kenya will no longer be able to shoulder the economic and security burdens of more than 600,000 refugees in the country. Karanja Kibicho, a senior secretary at the ministry, says an investigation by the security services found that the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab has been using the Dadaab refugee camp to recruit suicide bombers.
You know, this country has continued to face a lot of threats, mainly from Al-Shabaab and terror groups. And all the time when try to trace back, we have very strong cells in this country that have their roots in the refugee camps.
Refugees at Dadaab and Kakuma have been shaken up by this announcement. Halima Osman tells me that Somalia is still not fully functional yet.
I'm very proud to go in Somalia. It's my country. But there in Somalia, there is no security. You know, in Kenya, we have education. But in Somalia, we don't have.
But Kenyan Foreign Affairs Minister Amina Mohamed said the move to close down all refugee camps should, however, not come as a big surprise.
In 2013, we agreed with UNHCR and with the government of Somalia that we will begin this process. And we had a time frame. We have an agreement that's actually expiring sometime in September this year. And we have done absolutely nothing to implement that agreement. It's not Kenya's responsibility. It's an international obligation for everybody to do their bit. All hands must be on deck.
The government has not given any specific timeline as to when the process of shutting down the camps will begin. Karanja Kibicho from the Ministry of Interior did, however, say it will happen within the shortest possible time. This is not the first time Kenya is issuing these kind of threats. What's different this time around is that the government seems to be very serious about it, which puts the fate of Halima Osman and the nearly 600,000 refugees in Kenya on the balance.
Andrew Wasike in Nairobi. And as you just heard in that report, the Kenyan government says its decision to send the refugees back is mainly due to the threat posed by Al-Shabaab. The government claims the militants have been using refugee camps as a basis to launch attacks in Kenya. My colleague Abubakar Jalo has been speaking to Brian Sengoro Wanyama, a political commentator in Nairobi, about the impact of the government's decision.
The decision by the Kenyan government to close down refugee camps will have a great impact on the refugees. Now, to the children born in Kenya and those who have been integrated in Kenya, it's going to be a very big challenge because some of these young people, especially those below 20 years, have not known any other place as home apart from Kenya. Now, for them to be taken back to their home country, especially those from Somalia, for example, it's going to be very tricky. First of all, to integrate in terms of socialization. Two, to integrate in terms of the school system. And three, there's going to be a lot of psychological torture. I'm sure that they'll need a lot of counseling to cope with the new place of stay.
Kenya says that there is relative peace in Somalia And in a tripartite agreement between Kenya, UNHCR and Somalia, they agreed to send back the Somali refugees. But then the burden of doing the repatriation was left entirely on Kenya. Is that a good enough reason?
My take is that as much as we have people and organizations holding the opinion that Somalia is relatively peaceful, perhaps to Somalis it could be peaceful, but from the way what we read and from where I stand, I think that the security challenges in Somalia are fairly fluid. It is not yet a peaceful country. The government is not very stable. The Al-Shabaab group still is able to commit lots of to launch lots of attacks and maim people. So in a way, the refugees who are living in Kenya are worried, they're scared. And as for the tripartite agreement that there was, which gave Kenya a leeway to decide when to send back the refugees, I think that from where I stand, it would be prudent that the Kenyan government give this issue further reconsideration.
Now, Kenya is a signatory to the UN Charter that established the UNHCR. And now it is basically vehemently violating this charter by sending these refugees back home, who mostly say that Somalia, as you just mentioned there, is still not a safe country to return to. Is Kenya violating this, is infringing upon the human rights of these refugees?
And as far as the UN Convention is concerned, one would think that the Kenyan government is being fairly harsh. But if you look at the scale of damage and the scale of deaths, you know, if you look at the killing of the Kenyan soldiers in Somalia, I think the force that was used against the Kenyan soldiers was devastating. To say the least, I think that kind of attack was just meant to kill everybody and not to leave anybody alive.
Abubakar Ijale was speaking to Brian Sengero Wanyama, a political commentator in Nairobi. You're still listening to AfricaLink, coming to you live from our DW studios in Bonn, Germany. Still to come, South Sudan, 1 week after the unity government will peace hold.
AfricaLink, every weekday on DW Deutsche Welle.
In Uganda, government has heavily deployed in the capital, Kampala, ahead of the presidential inauguration due on Thursday, the 12th of this month. Armed soldiers and anti-riot police are hovering all over the city and its surroundings. The opposition has, however, vowed to continue their defiance campaign, ignoring a ban by the police. Both local and international media have been restricted from live reporting on opposition activities. DW's Alex Gita is in the thick of it all. He spoke to Abubakar Ijale about the current situation.
Well, situation-wise, President Museveni and his government have deployed the police and the army, most especially the anti-riot officers. They are patrolling the city and also the major towns in Kampala. There are some towns that are very active during these demonstrations, so there is visible security, both police and the army.
Now, the government has banned all coverage of opposition activities. Are there any new measures that the opposition and civil society organizations taking to counteract this ban?
Well, the FDC, the Forum for Democratic Change, the official political party for Kizza Besigye, who stood for elections, insist that they are going to continue with their defiance campaign. And this includes praying at different parts of the country, but also demonstrating against what they think is rights that have been denied.
So on the reporting front, has the media heed to this ban or are they defying it?
Actually, since the ban was announced by the Minister of Information on Thursday last week, no media house has carried any stories about these demonstrations. They have only carried out stories about the arrests because their source is the police. And this is what the government wanted them to do. The government said you can only report about the defiance if you get information from the police, but not report that, okay, this demonstration is taking place at this particular point.
So apart from the security situation in Kampala, how hyped is the capital in preparation of Museveni's inauguration?
Well, nothing much is taking place apart from a few businessmen who are taking the opportunity to make some money. They are printing T-shirts of President Museveni to sell on that day. Otherwise, the city has been quiet over the weekend, but people are going around their business. And the only other thing happening concerning the inauguration is the preparation at the Kololo airstrip, where national functions take place and where this function is going to take place. They are getting it ready, and but if you go around the city, you'll only see the police and the army patrolling the streets, and then that's when you know that maybe something major is taking place. But we expect in a few days, as is the norm, maybe the national flags of Uganda will be put around the city, and maybe some announcements are on the radio.
DW's Alex Gita in Kampala. Now, the people of South Sudan are holding their hopes for peace high after Riek Machar returned to the capital Juba and the formation of a new transitional government of national unity. Both President Salva Kiir and his deputy Riek Machar appeared in public pledging their commitment to the peace process. Kiir and Machar's new relationship is not a marriage of happiness, but is surely one that is keeping the guns silent. DW's James Manyula gives us a quick review of 1 week of South Sudan's new government.
Addressing the new cabinet ministers in the capital Juba to mark 1 week in office, President Salva Kiir stressed the importance of stability prevailing in the country.
The responsibility imposed on us by the agreement needs each and every one of us to contribute to the stabilization of our country. There is no blame that it was you who did this or who did that. If we do that, we will not move an inch. But if we forget about all what happened and start with a clean page, we will move.
Machar, back to his old post as the country's vice president, also briefly touched on the issue of security.
It's our task to ensure that this challenge will overcome it sooner, not only in Juba, all over the Republic. So once we stabilize the security, our economy will be stabilized.
However, Simon Momoja, an associate professor in the Department of Anthropology and Sociology at the University of Juba, does not think this new cabinet has anything different to offer.
There's no difference. These are the same people who led us into war, and now they're back. I hope they will begin to think anew.
James Okuk, a Juba-based independent security analyst, is optimistic about the transitional government. He thinks that both sides of the divide have the political will to put their young nation back on the road to peace.
The fact that it has brought all the heavyweight politicians in, it tells you now it is a heavyweight government and whose decision will not be undermined.
Okuk thinks the peace agreement gives clear designations to both President Kiir and his deputy Machar, which will prevent any future conflict.
Dikoriag has come back as a very powerful first vice president. He's not as his office is independent from the president office, and it has independent, powerful powers given to him by the agreement. They seem to the Council of Ministers, so they will all exert effort to build on the affairs of the government.
DW's James Manyula. Now, if you're a regular listener of AfricaLink, you'll certainly know what's coming up next. But if you're not, just relax and enjoy a popular drama series called Crime Fighters.
Deutsche Welle, learning by ear. Listen up, shape your future.
Welcome, it's time for our detective series Crime Fighters, Drugs to Cure, Drugs to Kill, by Mukoma Wangugi. This fourth episode is entitled Things Are Happening. In Ketago People's Republic, Detective Kalumba and his two colleagues are investigating the death of 21-year-old Peter, a poisoning made to look like a drug overdose. At Peter's funeral, the preacher suggested to them that a healer might have had something to do with the murder.
The name the preacher gave us, Johnston Lamatu, was that of a local traditional healer. It made sense. Whoever prepared the cyanide capsules had to have a good knowledge of medicine, access to illegal drugs, and a complete disregard for the law. So Chokbang Salamisha and I decided to pay Lamatu a visit. The image that comes to mind when people hear the words traditional healer is of backwoods, smoky hats, and creepy noises, but Lamatu's place was nothing like that. He lived on a small farm, keeping cows, goats, and chickens. In other words, he looked just like any other middle-class farmer, but there was no way the money he was making from the farm could have paid for that sparkling new four-wheel pickup. He seemed to be expecting us. At any rate, he showed no surprise.
I can see you're here on police business. Why?
Correct. I am Detective Kalumba, and these are my partners, Salamisha and Chokbank. Dr. Lamatu, do you know a boy called Peter?
There are many Peters in this world. I'm sure I know one.
How many Peters do you know who've recently been poisoned?
I heard about that unfortunate boy, but I can't see what it has to do with me.
Well, now, let's see. Can you tell us which medical school trains witch doctors?
Okay. First of all, I'm not a witch doctor. I'm a healer. The knowledge I have has been passed down from generation to generation. It's tried and tested. A witch doctor uses smokes and screens and incantations and tries to calm the patient's fears. I use science, traditional African science.
He's right, you know. Us calling him a witch doctor will be like him mistaking us for vigilantes.
Ah, Salimisha. This man is a charlatan. He sells miracle water, tonics to cure the incurable, cancer, AIDS and all.
I'm afraid, detective, it's you who is the charlatan.
Huh?
You're speaking of things you have no business talking about. Your misunderstanding of what I do is based entirely on hearsay.
Our apologies, Mr. Lamatu, but you do have work to do. We need to find Peter's killers, otherwise they may kill again. Can we put our differences aside and work together?
I didn't know the boy. Never saw him, not even once.
Well then, if you have nothing to hide, may we take a look around?
Do you have a search warrant?
No, we don't. We are hoping for a little good faith on your part.
Good faith? You want me to help you violate my own rights? Fine. Go ahead and look around. You'd better leave the place as tidy as you find it.
Thank you, Mr. Lamatu.
Okay, let's do it.
Hey guys, come here! I think I found something!
What is it, Kalumba?
What is it?
Let's have a look. What is it?
It looks like a capsule-making kit. See?
There must be thousands of capsules here. And what's that white powder? Lamatu, what is all this?
I've never seen that briefcase before. I don't use capsules for the medicines I prescribe. You can ask my patients.
Then what are they doing here?
I'm telling you the truth. Someone must have left it there for you to find, presumably. Don't you think that if it were mine, I'd have hidden it better? Or poured the contents down the toilet as soon as I had your car pull up?
I found it right here on your desk. You could have been hiding it in plain sight.
Did you ever consider that your informant might be misdirecting you? That they want you to look in all the wrong places?
We are going to get the powder tested and have the kit checked for prints. If they match yours, we are coming for you. And we won't be so polite next time.
You do that. I'll be waiting for your apology right here in my own home.
My gut feeling was that Lamatu was innocent, and Salamisha and Chokbank both agreed. It was all far too easy, and his explanation of how he practiced medicine made sense. He seemed to have respect for both his work and his patients. As we talked it over in the car, it became obvious that we needed to have a serious talk with the preacher. We were on our way there when my phone rang. It was forensics. They'd found a prescription note in some of Peter's belongings, from Mary Jane's pharmacy. We decided to split up. Salamisha and Chokbank would go and find the preacher, while I headed to the pharmacy. As I walked in, I missed a step, tripped, and did an awkward little dance to regain my balance. I looked up to see Mary Jane laughing at the off-balance detective.
What are you doing, spinning or dancing?
She was very beautiful.
Either way, welcome to Mary Jane's.
Oh, thank you. I am Detective Kalumba. I have a few questions for you if you don't mind.
All right, but I have the answers already.
You do?
Of course I do. I know nothing. Now go home and let me work.
Ask yourself why a moderately intelligent cop would show up on your doorstep if he didn't have a good reason. Let's show each other some respect.
I quite agree, Detective Kalumba. On the other hand, wouldn't you agree that mutual suspicion is more appropriate?
Let's keep it simple then. Mary Jane, what do you know?
Detective, I wish things were that simple. I'm a very busy woman. What is it that you want to know?
I'm investigating a murder. Fake drugs are involved. Your name came up. Shall we sit down and have a proper conversation?
I have a lot of work to do, Detective. Ask your questions.
This is why you tell me the truth, for your own sake, but also to do some good. Tell me, this young man, Peter, who killed him, do you know?
All I can tell you is our lives are over. You've woken an angry giant, Detective.
Mary Jane, are you expecting anyone?
No.
Hide in the bathroom.
Okay.
We are here, Kalumba.
We're here.
Chokbank, Salamisha, thank God.
Oh, Chokbank, are you okay?
Chokbank, hang on. Salamisha, do you see them? What's going on?
What's going on? That's a good question. Be sure to tune in next time to find out if the detectives managed to escape safely. You can listen to this episode again at dw.com/crimefighters. And now stay tuned for a meeting with a special guest, Mukoma Wangugi, the author of this series. The goal of Crime Fighters is not only to entertain, but also to give listeners useful knowledge. Why did you choose the topic counterfeit medicine?
Just the whole idea of there's something wrong about giving somebody fake medicine. You know, there's something I think morally wrong, maybe more than other crimes, you know, like shoplifting. I would say the idea of somebody coming to you, you know, and they have hope, you know, and they're sick, possibly it's a terminal illness, and then they end up with fake medicine is just wrong.
What do you hope to achieve with this series?
To entertain and to educate. To entertain, you know, because they're very lively characters, I think, and there are moments of suspense. So, and at the same time, to educate and raise questions around why people need fake drugs and to question the idea of that it's actually the poor who can't afford going to hospitals who end up buying the fake drugs, you know, and to question why African governments don't break patents, for example, AIDS, for God's sake. I mean, we should break the AIDS patent and make our own cheaper drugs.
In episode 4 of Drugs to Cure, Drugs to Kill, you depict a healer, Lamatu, who insists on using traditional African science instead of hocus pocus. How important is it for you to contradict clichés about Africa?
I think we have to fight those stereotypes that portray, you know, Africans as irrational, as without agency, as if, you know, they're just sitting there waiting for Western help. And I think once people can see the full humanity of Africans, then it becomes easy first not to exploit them. You know, there's a lot of exploitation going on, both by the African elites, but also by Western elites and Western governments. So I think it's very, very important to show that agency, to show that Africans are not just sitting around waiting for Western help, that, you know, they have people who practice African medicine, communities that come together in terms of a crisis, and their own heroes, you know, and so on and so forth.
Do you have a message for our listeners?
I hope you enjoy the story, but also listen to some of the questions that are being asked in the drama, you know, and also think of solutions.
Nice piece there. And before we leave you, here is a quick recap of our main stories. Somali refugees in Kenya have criticized the Kenyan government over its plan to deport all the 600,000 refugees seeking protection in the country. And Uganda has deployed armed soldiers in the capital Kampala ahead of President Museveni's inauguration on Thursday. Opposition leaders have vowed to disrupt the event. And South Sudan's unity government has marked a week in office, with both President Kiir and his rival Riek Machar pleading commitment to the peace process. That's all we had for you today. Thank you for listening. From me, Jen Ayeko-Kumet, enjoy the rest of your day.